We'll need 20 cartons of eggs.
Check.
160 cups of flaked coconut.
How many bags is that?
A lot. 16 pounds of unsalted butter.
Check.
And 80 pie plates.
Ed, this is only a book. This is a lot of effort to go to.
Only a book?
Sacco and Vanzetti, they were anarchists.
Are you kidding? They were the greatest comedy act you've never heard of.
No, Ed, in Mark Benelli's debut novel, the famed anarchist bombers are also a silent comedy team, like Laurel and Hardy.
Who are they? I grew up watching Sacco and Vanzetti. Sacco and Vanzetti needs women. Didn't you see that?
What do we do with the pies once we make them?
I don't know.
With the magic of radio, I'll show you.
This is Carolyn, and I'm here with Jessica from the LBC, aka Book Nerd. And we're going to talk about the book that she nominated for the Spring 2007 LBC Read This Pick, which is...
Sacco and Vanzetti Must Die by Mark Benelli, so, published by Dalkey Archive.
So tell us a little bit about the premise of Sacco and Vanzetti Must Die.
Well, Sacco and Vanzetti probably most people recognize as two Italian-American anarchists who were executed in the 1920s for trying to blow up a factory. Their trial was famously xenophobic, and they were championed by the left at the time as victims of a corrupt system, although they probably more or less did what they were accused of. But the Sacco and Vanzetti in this novel are not really the same people, although that gets complicated. They are actually a fictional slapstick comedy team in the style of Abbott and Costello or the Three Stooges or the Marx Brothers, and they go through a series of sort of film scenes and interviews and other scenarios that overlap with real life. Mark Benelli's explanation is that he took characters from an absurdist sort of slapstick comedy and put them in and gave them real character and real personalities, but didn't take them out of the absurd situation. So it's a little hard to explain, and as the book goes along, it gets more complicated because their lives sort of start to overlap with the real Sacco and Vanzetti, but it's great fun all the way through, and there's some amazing comic scenes in there. So that's sort of the basic description.
So one of the things I'm always curious about for people who make these nominations to the LBC is how they came to know the book, and I think you have a particularly interesting relationship with this one.
Yeah, it was kind of a funny story. I feel a little guilty about it because I feel like I started reading this book for almost unscrupulous reasons. I work in a bookstore, and I got invited to a book party for Mark Benelli by our sales rep from Dalkey Archive, who's kind of a friend and someone that I really liked. So I was going to go and eat their free food and drink their free wine, but I hadn't read this book. So I thought, you know, maybe since I'm going to go anyway, I should take a look at it just so that I don't look stupid or like I'm, you know, scamming the publisher. So I started reading. I first read an interview with Mark Benelli, and then I started reading this book and got completely involved in it. And I got to meet the author and talk to him a little bit about what he was doing and just felt like I'd made this amazing discovery of this new, really fun, really creative author working in kind of a new way. So yeah, it was unusual, but I've been championing it in the bookstore and on the web since then, so I feel lucky that I came across it.
Since it is such a complicated premise, but at the same time is so funny, what's your, like, elevator pitch? I'm sorry, that's my LA, old LA speak.
That's okay, that makes sense. I know, I was actually thinking about, it may come across as a little inaccessible to, like, your average reader. I mean, I feel like the Lit Blog co-op members are used to reading really out there kind of avant-garde fiction, but it can be kind of a hard sell to someone who's just looking for a good read. And I feel like the best way to read this book is to just sort of go with it, to let go of your expectations of linearity, of sharp lines between fiction and nonfiction, and just enjoy it scene by scene and let it build and resonate with you. Yeah, and enjoy the comedy and wait until you put the book down to sort of grapple with the larger issues that it brings up.
Wow, I feel like I need another cup of coffee to keep up with you.
I'm sorry, am I talking too fast?
No, it's just like how do I follow that up? That's perfect. For me, the book is a little nonlinear, and I feel a little guilty because I'm reading it in choppy bits and pieces. And then I look at it and I'm like, oh, it is in choppy bits and pieces. That's okay.
Yeah, I think I've talked to Mark a little bit about that. He actually comes into the bookstore where I work, and I think some of it has to do with his day job as a journalist. So he writes articles and short pieces, and he comes to writing fiction that way. You know, he'll write a scene, and then he'll write another scene, and then he'll do some more research, and he'll write something else, and come at it from a number of different angles. But, you know, his background is in newspaper and magazine writing, not in novel writing, so I think that comes across a little bit in the way the book is structured.
And as a as someone who has done some research into the period as well, like the sort of silent film era, like, I know that I'm curious about, like, what's real and what's not real in here. Like, when he talks about a boxer, is the boxer real or not real? And did you find yourself, like, wanting to run and look things up, or did you just, like, go with this sort of hybrid fiction unreality of the book and then worry about what was real later?
I think I enjoyed it first and then started wondering about it later. And I know that some of the characters are real. The boxer is a real person. The pilot is a real person. And all of the silent film stars who appear in it are real people, but they appear in pretty much entirely fictional context. So it's almost meaningless to find out what they did in real life because they're just characters. But there is a meaning to most of those allusions to historical figures, and I am looking forward to hearing more from Mark about why he included those and what they mean and how they fit into the context of the historical period and the sort of themes of the work he's created.
Well, it was a really fun read. Thank you so much for nominating it.
No problem. I'm glad you enjoyed it.
And do you have any final things to say to introduce Sacco and Vanzetti Must Die and Mark Benelli, who's coming up next?
I don't, except that you should ask him about what he's working on next, because I've talked to him about his next project, and it sounds like it's going to be something even more exciting and fun, and I'm just so pleased that we could talk to this first-time author and this great independent press Dalkey archive and highlight one of the best things that's come out of there in the last couple of years.
Great, thanks!
My Guguza Bella. She's my pizza.
So I'm
here power,
with Mark Benelli, author of Sacco and Vanzetta Must Die. Mark, how are you doing?
I'm pretty good. How are you?
I'm pretty good. I'm glad we could actually meet up for this. First off, I must ask, why Sacco and Vanzetta? Let's start with an obvious question here.
Well, I'm a first-generation Italian-American, and they were just, you know, they were just sort of characters from history who'd always kind of stuck with me. As a kid, I mean, it was basically, you know, as far as Italians in history class, you'd get Columbus, Sacco and Vanzetti, maybe like Mussolini if they made it up to world. And that was sort of it, you know? And so their story definitely sort of resonated with me as a kid and just, you know, just kind of stuck with me. And then later, you know, probably when I was in my 20s, I became just more interested in the sort of anarchist movement and just started doing a little reading. Was surprised to learn the extent to which Italian Americans and Italians were involved in sort of the most radical wing of the anarchist movement, and that Sacco and Vanzetti were part of that. So yeah, that was just, they were just always kind of like percolating there.
I'm curious how the stand-up comedy, and also specifically, there's numerous references in this book to 20th century film, even like Primo Carnera. The list goes on and on. I'm wondering how these figures kind of siphoned their way into the actual text here.
Well, it's kind of a very almost superficial reason. I was thinking about a novel, and I was thinking of like a genre that I could sort of mess with. I was actually thinking of the Coen brothers and the way they sort of take genre and kind of, you know, refract it through their own sensibilities, or like
Faulkner and Barton Fink.
Yeah. Yeah, well, just most of their films are some sort of weird, even something like O Brother, Where Art Thou, just like a weird sort of like the prison break, you know, genre, and then taking that and like sort of fucking with it. I like the idea of doing that. And so, you know, in my mind, I was just going through different genres I can sort of mess around with, and like, you know, something like noir is something I really like, but it's been done so much, so often and so well. And something like Westerns, you know, that doesn't appeal to me. It didn't appeal to me as much. And the sort of classic comedy film is something that that I always loved. Again, even as a kid, I would always watch Abbott and Costello movies with my dad. They would rerun them on Sunday mornings in Detroit, where I grew up. And so when I hit on the comedy team idea, I immediately liked that, and then at some point, I can't say when, but at some point the name Sacco and Vanzetti just popped into my head, and it was such a perfect, you know, comedy team name. I had the conceit, and, you know, it initially seemed so ridiculous, which it is, obviously, but then the more I thought about it, the more the sort of, you know, the parallel, you know, some of the parallels between between anarchism and slapstick started to come out, and it just kind of weirdly made more and more sense, and so I just decided to embrace it. And
well, Sacco and Vanzetti have a history of being in fiction. There's, of course, the Upton Sinclair fictionalization, and actually several novels that you cite sort of late in the book. But in your research notes, I noticed that you didn't reference any particular novels. Did you feel that you would be corrupted by previous fictive influences? Or?
I looked at all those novels. I didn't consider that research as much. I mean, like that. I don't know if you've checked out the Upton Sinclair. It's pretty. it's pretty abysmal. I mean, he's got.
Hardcore.
Yeah, I mean, you know, he's got the Vanzetti character. Like, he writes out his dialogue in this sort of phonetic like dialect, God. Like sort of Chico Marx style almost. It's just like literally saying stuff like, "Oh, Dante, the great poet," you know, but it's like written out. So I don't know. It really made me wince. I mean, he Sinclair obviously meant well, and you know, he was fighting the good fight for them, but. It's not a great novel. And then, you know, yeah, I mean, I definitely looked at some of the others. None of them really made as much of an impact as the nonfiction research that I did, you know, reading about some of the anarchists, some of the Italian anarchists who are lesser known, people like Luigi Galiani, who was basically openly promoting bombing and violence and sort of overthrowing the state by any means necessary. And this was the guy that Sacco and Vanzetti were sort of, you know, dedicated followers of. So that stuff was kind of interesting to me, particularly because, you know, I think the general sort of image of them is as, you know, martyr, victim. You just, you know, when you think of Sacco and Vanzetti, most people think of that sort of very iconic photograph of them sort of handcuffed together in the courtroom looking... you know, like these very sad sort of immigrants, you know, like waiting stoically to be executed, basically. The sort of radical bomb-throwing aspect of their lives is not as is forefronted often.
Well, let's talk about the connection between slapstick and anarchism. I want to actually remark upon one of the interesting aspects of the book. There are these frequent extemporaneous speeches often given by characters, such as the one character who basically... asks how funny actually jumping off of a building can be before it's not funny. And you really sort of cut to the close association between, you know, comedy and just outright violence like this. And the extemporaneous speeches actually kind of occur sort of midway through the book. I was wondering, I mean, they're almost like sort of little mini pamphlets to some degree. When did this kind of announce itself in the text?
The slapstick stuff specifically,
sort of
that kind
well,
of...
That, but also the sort of speeches that the kind of characters make where they go off in a long sort of, like, Dostoevsky-esque kind of, like, mini-philosophy about comedy.
That sort of weirdly appealed to me just because the idea of talking at length about comedy and what makes things funny is so patently not funny. and so, just perversely, I really like the idea of people... completely overanalyzing that kind of stuff, and yeah, I don't know. I think that can be, to me, it can be very amusing. As far as those types of speeches, I'm not sure. You know, the book. I didn't write the book chronologically. You know, I wrote. It's so fragmented, as you know, and so it just came in various chunks, and I can't say exactly why those speeches came out the way they did, but I don't know.
Did they announce themselves sort of midway through writing, or perhaps, you know, were they there from the get-go?
Probably about midway, I would say, you know. Yeah, like the earliest stuff I did, I knew early on I wanted to have scenes... I like the idea. I mean, one of the things that really appealed to me about doing a fictional comedy team was that I could sort of make this whole sort of filmography. You know, it just seemed really fun.
Sacco and Vanzetti needs women. Yeah.
Yeah. So just dropping them into these different sort of crazy, you know, Abbott and Costello, Laurel and Hardy type scenarios, and just being able to kind of dip my toe into, like, you know, a dozen different worlds like that. So that was very appealing to me. So those were the earliest scenes I started writing. And then I think pretty quickly after that, I started doing some of the transcript sections, you know, the sort of fake interviews with Sacco and Vanzetti. And that got their kind of, the rhythm of their sort of whole patter going. And that so that helped sort of cement them, the characters in my mind. And then, I don't know, I liked, from the beginning, I definitely liked the idea of being able to just dip into different sort of radically different styles throughout the book, you know, whether it was like the transcripts or stuff like the fake film writing. It was just, I don't know if it's just like a short attention span thing or what. I mean, it was also the first time I'd ever attempted a novel after having like written short stories, you know, fairly unsuccessfully for a while. So I think the short form that throughout the book, the short forms made writing a novel feel much more manageable to me. So,
well, one of the things I should remark on too is that a lot of these little profile pieces seem to me kind of perhaps a way for you to write for the kind of profile pieces that you couldn't write at Rolling Stone. I was wondering if this was kind of the thing, the engine that kind of kept you going to some degree.
Yeah, sure. I mean, you know, like definitely I think some of the sort of journalistic flourishes in the book, you know, I take stuff that I do in my day job and kind of exaggerate it crazily in ways that I could never do.
Write what you know, yeah.
So, you know, yeah, whether it's sort of like fake interviews or kind of just crazy over-the-top film writing, it was fun. It was definitely fun to take those sort of journalistic conventions and kind of, you know, fuck with them and exaggerate them and do weirder stuff.
You described in an interview with Ted McDermott how there was this great sensation when you came back from research, something that actually you picked up from Michael Chabon, where you just felt a physical pleasure from actually conducting research. I wanted to actually ask you, in the course of doing research with this, now some novelists who are very research heavy, it's a matter of sort of copying what they find from their notes into their book. I'm sure this had to pose some kind of problem for you. What steps did you take to ensure that you weren't going to, you know, just basically sort of copy text verbatim and actually keep the level of invention at a kind of easy sort of steady level?
Well, I guess, you know, the whole having Sacco and Vanzetti as a comedy team, yeah, ensured a certain level of absurdity throughout the whole book. So, but you're totally right. I mean, I definitely, especially with some of the more obscure sort of anarchist history, some of it is just so great. I mean, I definitely found myself falling into that kind of classic researcher's trap where you just love what you're researching so much and you just want to tell everybody about it, and like, you know, and you feel like you're discovering this sort of you know, this like hidden knowledge, you know, that very, very few people know about. And so, but yeah, I mean, like one of the things I did, like I found some stories, historical stories that I found particularly interesting, I kind of turned into little sort of historical fictions that I kind of wrote in my own way and kind of messed around with a little bit. You know, there's one, and again, this goes back to slapstick. I was surprised at how much of, you know, in the course of my research, how much of the sort of anarchist movement, often the stuff that was going on in Italy, but even over here, I mean, some of it was sort of so bungling and slapstick-like. The one I'm thinking of is this anarchist in Chicago decided to kill the cardinal, the newly ordained, I guess, cardinal of Chicago, and said he was at this banquet and decided to like poison the soup. The anarchist got this job in the kitchen, and he used... He didn't use quite enough arsenic, and so everybody got sick, and like there was mass vomiting, but nobody actually died. So it's just this kind of crazy slapstick scenario that it's almost unbelievable, you know. And so yeah, so I had to use that kind of stuff, and for that, in that case, I ended up, you know, just kind of writing it as a little sort of like short story almost, from the point of view of the cardinal's assistant. In other cases, you know, in some cases I did sort of quote things verbatim, you know, it was kind of like a case-by-case basis, but yeah.
When did knife throwing become funny for you?
Well, the knife thing comes from, you know, my father was a knife sharpener. He's first generation Italian-American. He was born in this little town in northern Italy called Pinzolo, and there just happened to be a lot of knife grinders who come out of this area of Italy. So yeah, that was, again, another thing that was just always like sort of in the back of my mind, and you know, thinking about sort of the early film comedies, you know, so many of these, the scenarios revolved around kind of menial labor, or just, you know, it was very often sort of, and this fit very well with the sort of anarchist theme, it was very often these sort of bottom class people sort of trying to stick it to the man, you know, whether it's, I don't know, you know, Abbott and Costello, they're like working as plumbers and they like crash some sort of high society ball or something, you know, things like that. And so thinking about, you know, what sort of job Sacco and Vanzetti, my fictional Sacco and Vanzetti, could be doing, you know, knife grinding seems so perfect. It's such a, it seems like such an archaic, like 1930s type profession that nobody really does anymore. So it was very perfect. You know, it fit perfectly as far as that went. And then, yeah, then it was just a quick sort of jump to like the knife routine, which my father never did anything like that. But
I can't think of a movie. The latest movie I can think of that actually deals with a knife thrower is, there's this cheesy Anthony Michael Hall movie from 1986 called Out of Bounds, I believe.
I think there may be a Buster Keaton one. I'm not positive.
There's a short, right?
Yeah.
Is it one of the two-reeler ones that he did for Columbia in his 40s?
I'm not sure. Or is it one of the early ones he did? He did a few with Arbuckle too, right? Yeah, it might have been one of those, but I'm not 100% sure. And I know, like, after the fact, like after I had settled on this conceit, I started like obsessively like watching a lot of these old comedy films, and I'm pretty sure one of them, you know, I don't know that he's a knife grinder, but there's some knife stuff in there.
It's pretty
unusual.
I was going to ask you about the meat metaphors in this book. You have a few of them, like you compare a man's, I think it's in Primo's case, you compare his hands to steak dinners. And I noticed, I counted at least four when I read this book. So what's up with that?
Well, you know, that's a thing I should discuss with my therapist, I guess. I'm not sure. I hadn't noticed that.
Yeah.
I don't know. Well, you know, it might go back to the knife thing, I guess. I used to work for my dad, and I would deliver knives and spend a lot of time in butcher shops. So maybe, I have no idea.
Okay. Oh, yeah, actually, I wanted to ask you, you know, going back to this research, about, were there any figures that you kind of, you know, that were initially in the draft that inevitably kind of went away, that you, you know, obviously you're burgeoning your head with all of this, you know, cultural information, some things have to fall by the wayside. Were there any particular minor characters in history that were sort of competing for the attention of all the other ones?
Yeah, I mean, I really, at a certain point, I had to kind of, I mean, the original draft was more like 500 pages, and it was just too much, you know. And you know, when I started conceiving it as this kind of this hyper Italian book, where, you know, the characters would be encountering all sorts of, you know, semi obscure Italians from the 20th century, people like Primo Carnera and Italo Balbo. I found lots of others who, you know, I really loved and wanted to include. I mean, I had a whole section on Carlo Tresca, who was another anarchist who came to the States and founded this anarchist newspaper called Il Martello, the Hammer, and he was actually murdered on the street in New York, and his murder remains unsolved. They think it was, there's some sort of mob thing and possibly connected to these pro Mussolini fascist group. And then, yeah, I just, you know, I did so much. I found so many great characters. I mean, I think at one point, I think the guy who created, who either founded Planters Peanuts or created the Mr. Peanut logo was Italian.
Really?
And I had taken notes on that and had some idea about working him. And then I think that was the point where I was like, you have to stop. That's just too much. You can't bring in the Mr. Peanut Italian. Like, that's just one too many. So yeah, there was definitely stuff I had to lose, unfortunately. But
you know, to some degree, you could almost call this book it's obviously a very conceptual book in the sense that it has supplementary material, poems, all manner of transcripts, as we've sort of discussed. Did you find yourself in the course of writing this, you're thinking in terms of this conceptual mindset, and did this prove an obstacle? I mean, how did this eventually get to Dahlke's hands? Did other publishers say no to this, or?
Well, actually, I mean, the way it got to Dahlke is, you know, I wrote the book and just thought I would kind of do the traditional, publishing route, just like get an agent and then the agent would deal with selling it. And in my mind, I mean, I always, you know, I love Dahlke. I love, you know, I knew it was a weird book that would sort of work better at a press like that, and assumed it would end up somewhere like that. But I also wasn't thinking that much about it. And I guess, I don't know. I mean, kind of naively, in the end, I assumed, you know, the fact that I also write for Rolling Stone, and you know, I'm capable of writing extremely mainstream, totally straight,
yeah.
You know, stuff, which anyone could see by looking at my nonfiction work. I kind of figured agents would look at a manuscript like this and say, okay, it's a strange book. We're not going to make a lot of money off of it, but, you know, we'll do some nonfiction book that we could sell for lots more money later. And I probably spent like 9 months, you know, sending it out to agents with no luck. I mean, people would sort of sit on it for a really long time. And, you know, the agent who liked it the most ended up having this drug problem. He kind of dropped out of the scene for a while. So, like, finally, I know how the publishing world works. I know that, the slush pile is really not a smart way to go if you can avoid it. But I was finally like, you know, nobody's biting. I should just, you know, submit directly to some of these small presses where I think it'll end up anyway. Mm-hmm. You know, and a lot of presses like Dahlke have just sort of submission guidelines right on their website. And I was reluctant to do that because I love the idea of being published by Dahlke, but didn't think a slush submission would be taken seriously. But thankfully, it was. I mean... they did a fantastic job with it. So
I hooked you up with me at BEA too.
yeah, Chad yeah, Post.
You were the star of Dahlke for a while.
right.
I wanted to actually also go back to the extemporaneous speeches, and we kind of didn't get into it so much, but there are also these interesting sort of dichotomous asides, such as the whole dick to the tree thing, you know. Yeah. Do you want to cut your balls off or actually kill yourself? I mean, and these are sprinkled throughout the book, and I want to sort of ask about this nature of philosophy that filters through these little, you know, whether it's a sort of strange what if question where you only have two grisly scenarios or you have like these long speeches.
I mean, I guess part of that, you know, thinking about the anarchist movement and these guys sort of at that time, you know, these guys, you know, huddled in small rooms, you know, just hashing out, having these sort of philosophical, really serious sort of philosophical debates about, you know, what the world should be like. And so I guess, you know, part of that maybe came, what you're talking about in the book maybe came through me translating some of the feeling of that sort of philosophical back and forth to these characters. And, you know, in the translation, I mean, some of what they talk about is that kind of stuff, but a lot of it is, you know, dick jokes or you know, what...
It also keeps the humor flowing.
Yeah, so. What makes comedy work. And so, yeah, like, they're that's sort of inherent in their characters. Even in my fictional Sacco and Vanzetti, that sort of philosophical wrangling, I guess, is inherent. I hadn't really thought that much about it, you know, but I think that's probably where it comes from.
Oh, yeah, I wanted to actually ask you about the trial chapters. There's something I observed, and maybe you can remark upon this, where the text itself becomes more fragmented the closer we get to the possibility that it could be the real Sacco and Vanzetti. The trial, for example. The first trial chapter reads like, oh, is this like some sort of thing I didn't know about it? And then you learn in the second trial chapter, oh, well, there's actually, it's a completely different sort of situation. So I was wondering, was this an effort on your part to just really sort of try to make things a lot more fragmented the closer you got to, you know, to the real as opposed to the imagined?
I definitely was, did want things to become more you know, anarchic, for lack of a better term, as the book progressed. As the sort of fictional and real Sacco and Vanzetti's were starting to converge in weird ways. The trial section that you mentioned is actually just straight from the transcript. I just sort of plucked random lines from the transcript that sort of stuck out at me. Partly some of it is just kind of a mechanical structural thing. I felt like a book of this length, without that much of a plot that's sort of, driving the narrative forward, I felt like, the fragmentation, the increased fragmentation and the sort of speed and shortness of the later chapters would give it a little bit of momentum that maybe, it would be lacking otherwise. So that was part of it as well.
Oh, yeah, actually, I wanted to talk, really quick, going to this conceptual idea of this book reminded me of early Coover. It also reminded me of, I'm not sure if you're familiar with Tom Carson's book, Gilligan's Wake.
No, I haven't. I know about the book, and actually, I've hung out with him before.
Oh, really?
His wife is a good friend of an ex-girlfriend of mine.
Gotcha.
I went to a Halloween party at his house, actually. Weirdly, he was dressed as MacArthur. But anyway, that's
interesting.
I've not read his novel.
Oh, it's interesting in the sense that both of these books, and there are many other authors who do this, where they basically abscond with cultural information and just completely reinterpret it. In the case of Gilligan's Wake, which seems to me, I guess, the last really major book that did this, just basically taking all of the Gilligan's Island characters and interspersing them into history with all manner of wordplay. And I'm wondering if why you feel that there is a kind of lack of this. Is this a sort of fear of postmodernism? Is this a fear of, I guess, a conceptual book? Obviously you just described to me that you had some serious problems getting this thing looked around. Why do you think people are reluctant? Is it really one of those situations where it's like the James Woods-style hardcore realists are the only things that matter in the literary world?
You don't want to be griping about people not reading experimental fiction. I know the type of book I wrote, and, I'm happy, that it was published and people are reading it at all. And, it's not like I expect some sort of mass audience for a book of this sort. It's hard to say, more to your question, like are people not writing this type of book, or are they just not getting published, or... I'm not sure, I feel like, a lot of what gets held up as sort of postmodern, the more prominent examples are often really bad. I'm talking about like recent books, and so then, it just turns, readers and critics, can very easily dismiss all of it as, this kind of game playing. You hear people say that a lot. It's just playing games, or it's just,
puzzle box kind of novels,
yeah. And the bad ones are really bad, but the writers, if you look at early Coover and stuff like that, it's so amazing. I just read for the first time The Adventures of Mao and the Long March, the Frederick Tootin book.
I have not read that. Yeah.
That's a really interesting book. Sort of going to an earlier question you asked about sort of appropriating huge chunks of text. That book, he'll have like a bit of his own prose, and then a character will speak, and there'll be a long chunk in quotes. And in the back of the book, you'll realize the whole quote will be from an obscure Thomas Hardy essay, or he's just basically making this collage out of other people's writing. And
did you read Jonathan Lethem's Harper's Essay, where he did the exact same thing in nonfiction form?
I didn't read it, no. I heard him interviewed about it on some NPR show. That sounds like an interesting piece. Yeah, I want to check that out. But yeah, that was terrific. Anyway, I think, that type of writing, I love, all kinds of fiction. I mean, I'll read, you know, full-on realist stuff, obviously. But when that kind of more unusual or experimental stuff works well, it gets me more excited than any other type of writing, I think. So,
why is that, do you think?
I don't know. Shock of the new. I'm not really sure. I just
something to, you know, kind of fill up the engines that way.
I mean, like Coover's short story, "The Babysitter," was the first story I read. That was the story that made me want to write fiction. Like I read that, I think, when I was like a freshman or sophomore in undergrad, and that was one where I was like, wow, you could do that, you know, and. You know, as much as I love John Coover, he's great. Stuff like that, I'm not sure. It just speaks to me in a different way.
Well, it's getting cold and dark, but Mark, it was a pleasure chatting with you.
Thanks so much.
And everywhere I go, people know the part I'm playing. Paid for every dance, selling his romance. Oh, what they see. There will come a day and youth will pass away. What will they say about me when the